I'm Mike Lecouteur. Joyce Napier is away today. Coming up, facing massive airport delays, the government suspends random COVID-19 testing.
All along, our response has evolved with the evidence and the science, and we need to continue to be flexible to look at that evidence.
Almost 500,000 international travelers were delayed arriving at Canada's busiest airport in May as officials at Pearson called for the easing of border measures. But will stopping that arrival testing be enough to clear the log jams? MPs debate in just moments. Then, blaming Donald Trump.
Donald Trump, the President of the United States, spurred a mob of domestic enemies of the Constitution to march down the Capitol and subvert American democracy.
Dramatic new footage and jarring testimony as the Congressional Committee on the January 6th insurrection points the finger at Donald Trump. We get the latest from Washington. And Canada has resettled 15,000 Afghan refugees, but nearly a year after the fall of Kabul, is Canada failing Afghan allies who supported our military and diplomats? A parliamentary report is calling for sweeping reforms. Retired Major General David Fraser digs in. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players. What will it take to clear the runway and get lines moving at Canada's busiest airport? The federal government is suspending random testing at all major airports starting tomorrow through to June 30th. Then, in July, testing will move off-site. Just yesterday, the Greater Toronto Airports Authority called on the federal government to temporarily pause airport COVID screening. The GTAA also said that nearly 500,000 international travelers experienced a delay last month alone. But is removing the testing the answer? Or is it time for bigger changes? Just today, a Liberal MP said it's time to move on.
These mandates were important. There's a high vaccination rate. We have Canadians safe. There's a lot less people that have died here per capita than many other countries. So the mandates worked. The mandates are important. But now it's probably time to move on.
So will dropping tests relieve some of the pressure ahead of the busy summer travel season? Or is it just a Band-Aid on a bigger problem? Let's bring in the MPs. Joining me now are Liberal MP Talib Noor Mohammed, Conservative Transport Critic Melissa Lantzman, and NDP Transport Critic Taylor Bacharach. Welcome all. Thanks very much for taking the time. We'll start with Ms. Lantzman. Now, you have long been calling for the federal government to lift mandates. So what do you think of today's announcement?
Well, I actually think today's announcement is a poorly thought-out reaction to what we saw from the U.S. today, which is a dropping of restrictions on international travelers, which is the right thing to do. What we've done today, let's walk you through it. We have put a pause on testing, only to reintroduce it July 1st. So it might temporarily alleviate the backlog at airports, but no one can possibly believe that there is magical health advice that came out today that says testing is keeping us safe, but not for the next 20 days, only to reintroduce us and continue keeping us safe on July 1st at another location. That's what the government did today, and I think it's a reaction, and I think it's a poorly thought out one.
Mr. Bacharach, what do you think of this?
Well, I think the government needs to provide more information. People are extremely frustrated. I've been spending a lot of time in airports and talking with frustrated travelers, and they want answers. They want to know from the government what the evidence is that has led to these public health measures, how the public health measures work, and what the plan is going forward. I think the government did a much better job of that earlier in the pandemic. They were more forthcoming, more transparent, and that's really tailed off. And now, with the remaining public health measures, I really feel they should be based on the public health evidence, and our public health officials should be transparently communicating that to Canadians, why the remaining measures are necessary. And we aren't hearing that from the government. And a lot of people are really frustrated by that.
So, Mr. Noor Mohammed, I mean, just today we had Theresa Tam basically saying that on a lot of these measures, the ball is in the politicians' court right now. So what's on the table right now for your government, and when will your government actually do more, as you're hearing from some of these opposition MPs?
Well, let me first begin by responding to what Ms. Lantzman said. First of all, you know, this issue related to texting is not the be-all and end-all of the challenges that folks are talking about. You know, when you talk about delays, when you talk about the issues at screening points, this is something that we've already addressed. We've now got more than 850 folks that have been hired by CATSA to start doing the work of screening Canadians. This is a team effort between airports, airlines, and us, whether it's PHAC, whether it's CATSA, so on and so forth, to ensure, and CBSA, to make sure these problems get solved. These are the decisions that we make are ones that not only we can't just make a decision today, snap our fingers, and expect the outcome to be tomorrow. So we are acting in the best interest of Canadians as we have through the pandemic. As science changes and the information from science evolves, we will also make relevant decisions. But in terms of delays and the challenges that flyers are facing, I mean, everyone should rest assured that the Government of Canada is doing all it can and doing it in partnership with airlines and airports to address the issues that folks are facing.
But in the meantime, I mean, you say it's a team effort, but right now it doesn't feel like passengers feel like you're on their team. So what do you say to them? They're standing in these lines.
Well, I would first of all reassure them and tell them that we are doing everything that we can. Hiring folks to do the work that is required cannot happen overnight. Folks need to be trained. They need to be security cleared, so on and so forth. We now have 850 people that have been hired in the last couple of months to address these issues. CATSA is back essentially to 100% of its hiring levels. That's going to make a huge difference. And we've already seen that less than 3% of folks at Pearson and YVR had to wait more than 30 minutes. In fact, 90% of passengers at Pearson have been waiting under 15 minutes. So the delays that folks are seeing are happening around the world, and Canada is moving quickly to address those issues in a way that actually will serve the interests of the entire travel industry, particularly travelers.
Ms. Lantzman, I'll bring you back in here. I mean, what do you think what you're hearing from Mr. Noor Mohammed?
We can't aim to be the worst, and we are amongst the worst, and that is clear. We are getting a reputation for it. It's all over the news, and you can say whatever you want, but we haven't even hit the height of travel season. What I will say is that today Canada is one of the only countries that doesn't allow unvaccinated travelers to travel within Canada. We allow unvaccinated international travelers in. We allow inmates to be transferred by air. But we are punishing, ideologically punishing, based on no evidence that my colleague has seen or that anybody in cabinet has shared. You cannot travel in this country if you are unvaccinated. You are still resuming testing on July 1st. These are not measures. They are half measures. They are a reaction of the U.S., and the government is under pressure, and rightfully so, from Canadians, because those lineups at Pearson are an abdication of responsibility by this federal government.
So, Ms. Lantzman, is it as simple as you asking for them to show their math, essentially? If they can show the science, then you'll be satisfied with it?
Well, we've had people on your network saying that these mandates don't work. We've had the chief public health officer of this country say that mandates need to be revisited. We've had airlines, airports, chambers of commerce, and members of the own Liberal caucus calling for the end of the mandates. So, you know, it's not just conservatives, and you're certainly not hurting conservatives. What they are doing is they are hurting Canadians without justification for their travel measures. Everybody else in the world has done it. It's our turn now. We are an outlier.
Mr. Noor Mohammed, I'm going to come to you, then just go to Mr. Bachrach in a second. But when you consider the fact that it sounds like caucus is starting to really push back a little bit and saying that, look, it's time. I mean, I know you can't reveal, you know, caucus confidence and break that type of thing. But what is the feeling within the party right now in terms of how everybody is, you know, feeling about this? Is everybody just towing the line, or is there an admission here that maybe this is time?
Well, let me first say, Ms. Lantzman, we started this conversation talking about delays. Now we've moved into mandates. I mean, this is the issue with conservatives. When there is, when there are facts
presented, but the, okay, but hold on, but hold on.
So now let's talk about the question that you.
No, no, but hold on, Mr. Noor Mohammed. What's happening at the airports? And we will stay on subject here, but because of some of the things that are around the mandates are affecting what's happening at the airports. So they are tied together, with all due respect.
So let's talk about the issue that you've just raised. Every time science has presented us with information, we've responded. You know, we are not operating in a vacuum. If science shows that lifting mandates make sense, that's what we'll do. If science tells us the opposite, we will keep that guidance in place. So what Canadians can be assured of is that we will look and we will continue to review what comes our way. And if the data and the evidence shows that mandates need to be changed, that's what we'll do. But again, going back to the issue of delays, there is no universe in which somebody saying it is because unvaccinated travelers can't travel, that we have a delay problem at the airports. I mean, this is conflating two totally unrelated issues.
Mr. Bachrach, last word to you right here.
Thanks, Mike. So on the delays, absolutely. The number one issue contributing to these delays is a staffing issue. And this was entirely predictable. The Liberals should have anticipated that when they lifted the restrictions on travel, people were going to want to travel in huge numbers. The fact that they're hiring people now who aren't going to be on the job for several more weeks just shows that they're scrambling to play catch up for a situation, really, that should have been acted on months ago. So that's I think that's the thing that we're missing in this picture, is the fact that, the government is behind the eight ball and they're trying to play catch up and get those people on the job. When it comes to the mandates, we need the government to provide the evidence. They need to explain the public health advice that they're getting from Dr. Tam. And they haven't been doing that. And people are getting more and more frustrated because they see other jurisdictions that don't have the same public health measures, and they wonder why in Canada we have certain measures. Now, ultimately, we need to make these decisions in the interest of people's health, but the government has a responsibility to be transparent and to answer people's questions and be forthright and forthcoming, and they simply haven't been doing that. It's incredibly frustrating.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. Mr. Noor Mohammed, Ms. Lantzman, Mr. Bachrach, thanks very much for making the time. We really appreciate it, guys. Coming up, never seen before footage and shocking testimony. The Capitol Hill insurrection hearings went prime time last night with a warning that U.S. democracy remains in danger. CTV's Joy Malbin has the latest from D.C. next.
Donald Trump was at the center of this conspiracy. And ultimately, Donald Trump, the President of the United States, spurred a mob of domestic enemies of the Constitution to march down the Capitol and subvert American democracy.
When a president fails to take the steps necessary to preserve our union, or worse, causes a constitutional crisis, we're at a moment of maximum danger for our republic.
Donald Trump is to blame for the Capitol Hill insurrection. That's the message from the House committee tasked with investigating the events of January 6, 2021. Last night, the American people and the world tuned in for the first of several hearings digging into the bipartisan panel's findings. So, what does this mean for the 45th President of the United States? Let's find out. Joining me now is CTV National News Washington Bureau Chief Joy Malbin. Welcome, Joy, and thanks for taking the time for talking to us. I wanted to know what you thought the key takeaways were from last night's hearing.
The key takeaway would be the fact that after 1,000 witnesses, this committee, Republicans and Democrats, believe and allege and say they have evidence that Donald Trump conspired, that there was a month-long plot to overturn the election, and that he had a seven-point plan. Part of it was to talk about the big lie, what it's known as down here, that there was election fraud, when aide after aide, his attorney general, even his own daughter said, there's nothing there. You lost the election. The fact that they had talked about seizing voting machines, rerunning the election, a conspiracy to undermine the presidential election of Joe Biden.
Yeah, and you're talking about some of that testimony from some of the big names. I mean, how shocking was it to see some of that and some of the footage that we're putting on right now? Even that is some unseen footage that a lot of these lawmakers thought they had seen at all, but clearly not.
Look, a year and a half after this, people have forgotten. They've moved on. They're worrying about other things like gas prices, inflation, mass shootings. But this powerful video brought it all back, the horror. You had firsthand testimony from some of these police officers, like Carolyn Edwards, who said that she was walking in people's blood, that she has a traumatic brain injury. There was a front row of other police officers that were there, as well as widows of police officers who died during that day. And they were weeping, openly weeping. It was very powerful evidence to bring everybody back and to get Americans to care about this, even though it's been a year and a half.
Yeah, Joy, I've only got about a minute left. So do you think this will work, especially when you consider the midterms are coming up?
Look, that's the challenge for this committee. 20 million people watched on prime time last night, ABC, NBC, CBS. Fox News, of course, did not carry it. That's more than the Oscars. So clearly Americans are engaged. But, you know, Trump Nation, some Republicans, they're saying it's all a sham. And, of course, Donald Trump says, here we go again, another witch hunt, calling it a hoax.
Yeah. Thanks for this, Joyce. Joy, really appreciate it. Joy Malbon in D.C. tonight for us. And on the other U.S. coast, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau addressed his hemispheric counterparts at the Summit of the Americas, highlighting the war in Ukraine, global inequity, and calling for carbon tax take-up. Is he finding support at the LA summit? CTV's Annie Bergeron-Oliver joins us now from Los Angeles. Annie, Prime Minister Trudeau pushed for climate action and carbon pricing at the summit today. Did he make any progress?
Well, you know, the government says that they absolutely did make progress, and they point to this agreement that was signed with California, you know, really moving the climate partnership between Canada and California forward. They did have an agreement in 2019. Now they have this new agreement that adds additional areas of priorities, talking about sharing information, working together when it comes to issues like electric vehicles, when it comes to reducing emissions, when it comes to protecting biodiversity and nature and the ocean. So the government points to that as a sign that this was progress, that things did get done. You know, the government has also talked a lot about how this summit was really about engaging and meeting with as many leaders as possible. The prime minister has met with a number of different leaders from different countries, Ecuador, Belize, Jamaica, Chile. Today is Haiti and the Dominican Republic. So there have been a number of conversations, and in every single one, climate change and the environment have come up. So, you know, who defines exactly what progress looks like? That's up to the government, but there definitely have been some milestones. I think the question some of the experts I've been talking to are saying is, what types of clear, concrete difference and change will come out of this summit? And that's something that we will have to just wait and see.
Yeah, and speaking of waiting and seeing, he will have his closing press conference a little later on tonight. What are you expecting? What are you watching for in that?
Well, I think one of the questions that I have is a little bit about this migration pact that has been signed here today. It was pushed by the United States. Canada is committing to bringing in 4,000 migrants from the Americas over the next 5 years, up until 2028. So, you know, 4,000 doesn't really seem like a significant number when you consider how many people are moving through the Americas, especially into the U.S. border every year. So that's the question that I have for him. Where did this 4,000 number come from? How quickly do you really think it will take? Is it going to be the later half, later towards 2018? Will this be next year? Is this just a very early initiative? Then Canada's also going to be giving $27 million to be able to help with this program. The other thing is, well, exactly what does that look like? Where is this going? It's going to be talking about the programs that can help speed up and integrate issues at the border to make it easier for asylum seekers to get through, more streamlined processes. But, you know, where is this money going and how quickly can it be getting out next year? So those are some of the questions. But I think also one of the big ones that we're going to be asking him is about the border. So not really related to the summit, but, you know, also an important question.
Very important questions. And we'll be watching for your reporting tonight on CTV National News later on. Thanks for that. Annie Bergeron-Oliver in Los Angeles today for us. Well, here is some other news you need to know. Canada hit a record low unemployment, with Statistics Canada reporting that 40,000 new jobs were added last month. Gains were in full-time employment. 135,000 full-time positions were created, but part-time employment fell by 96,000. May's unemployment rate dropped to 5.1%. That's the lowest since at least 1976. And Pope Francis is canceling an upcoming trip to Congo and South Sudan. The Vatican this morning confirming the African trip has been postponed under doctor's orders, and no new date has been set. The Pope is undergoing therapy for his right knee and has been using a wheelchair for about a month. Pope Francis is scheduled to visit Canada July 24th to the 29th, when he'll meet with residential school survivors. And today, the Catholic Archdiocese of Edmonton said at this time, they are still moving forward with planning for that visit. And Canada could become the first country in the world to require a health warning on every single cigarette. Addictions Minister Carolyn Bennett says the move is meant to help educate smokers, especially young people, who are more likely to share cigarettes and miss warnings on those packages. The cigarette packages will also be upgraded to include a longer list of smoking's health effects. Coming up, Conservative leadership candidates could battle it out over the votes of some 600,000 members. But does a larger voting pool create more hurdles in the race? Our Friday political panel of strategists will weigh in next. We're taking a timeout right now, but Power Play will be right back. Welcome back. More than 600,000 members of the Conservative Party could be eligible to vote in this year's leadership race. Now, we say could because the party still has to verify all those members before finalizing the list by July 29th. Still, it's a staggering number when you consider the 2020 race had under 300,000 eligible voters. So, how should candidates capitalize on this unprecedented membership pool, especially when Pierre Poilievre's team claims that they have signed up more than half of those 600,000? Let's take this to our panel of strategists. Greg McEachern is from Proof Strategies, and he leans liberal. Melanie Paradis is a conservative strategist. She was the former conservative leader, Erin O'Toole's director of communications. Anne McGrath is the NDP's national director, and Greg Weston from Earnscliffe Strategy as a nonpartisan perspective. Thank you all for being here on this wonderful Friday. Let's start with Melanie. Over 600,000 members. It's an astounding number. You know that getting the vote out is key. So how do you translate the excitement that someone once had when they signed up at a rally into actually mailing in that ballot? And who do you think faces a steeper climb on that front?
So I've actually since heard today that the number is over 700,000. The reason why people keep saying, the reason why people keep saying over 600,000 is because there's likely some duplication. And so they're just being conservative by saying we'll likely have to be some people that are, you know, removed from that total number. And that's why it's over 600. But regardless, it's a crazy huge number of people. But the real problem is there's no interim list for any of the campaigns to contact any of these people. So imagine in a traditional campaign, you go door to door and you knock on constituents' doors and you make your sales pitch to them. And maybe they say, hey, get off my lawn. Or maybe they stick around to chat with you. But you at least know that you can go to their door. The candidates right now have no idea who these 600,000 plus people are. They don't have any access to emails, phone numbers, mailing addresses, anything like that. So they can't reach them. It's a black hole. They've been communicating with the same 250,000-ish people for the past couple of months. And everyone that's been added since March to the membership pool, they're not hearing anything from these people. And I think that really needs to change. There's 22 people in Canada right now who sit on LEOC, which is the organization that governs the Conservative leadership race, and they have the power to change this tomorrow if they just decide to release the list, to an interim list, to the candidates.
And obviously that'd be helpful, but I can't get over how much of a chef's kiss this is that conservatives are being conservative with how many people they've actually signed up. But anyways, I'll leave that one for now. Greg McEachern, Pierre Poilievre's campaign team is claiming that they've signed up over 300,000 members. So do you think he has the support that would help him in a second or third round, or does he really have to win on a first ballot here?
His team is aiming to win on the first ballot. And I know that sounds kind of obvious, you want to win as quickly as possible, but it also explains why in some of the leadership debates he's not taken the usual front runner high road, where he's really gotten, you know, down and dirty They really want to have a first ballot win. I was talking to some of my conservative friends today, and Michael, yes, I have conservative friends. And, you know, what they're telling me is they have no issue. They don't think, you know, despite the back and forth about the numbers, they have no reason to believe that they're not, you know, valid. But again, it is very much from the Pulliver people. You know, it's those rallies you mentioned, Mike, where people were lined up to have their picture taken with Pierre. And you also saw people going with, you know, electronic notepads saying, well, you know, as long as you're getting your photo done with Pierre, what makes sense? Why don't you join the party? So right now, I think if you are not in the Pulliver camp, membership's cut off. This only has one place to go. It's where you can poach other members. And, you know, the way that usually works is it gets dirty. I think, you know, we're going to see some opposition research start to come out, because that is the only way, if you're in one of those other camps, that you can prevent him from winning at this point.
Now, I swear, Anne, Greg and I did not talk about the question ahead of time, but this is exactly where I wanted to go. So once we see those final numbers, how do other campaigns try and sort of poach out of Poilievre's supporters, or can they at this point? Are they just different people?
Well, I think there are a couple of ways. One thing is, it is true that these are eye-popping numbers. It is also true, though, I mean, while I agree with Melanie to some extent, one would assume that that each of the camps would know and be able to contact and stay in touch with the members they had actually signed up, plus they have the previous membership list. I'm very, very familiar with the problems of, like, the administrative problems of processing all of that, but I'm told that they are kind of on top of it, and that the list will be ready in a very short order, like 10 days to 2 weeks, so everybody will have access to those. But in terms of what you have to do next, if you're the front runner, which Poilievre obviously is, or you're one of the others, I think what Poilievre's camp is trying to do, to be honest, is trying to force Patrick Brown out by making it look impossible for him to be able to win, and force him into putting his papers in for the mayor's race in Brampton. In terms of timing, I think that's really critical for them. The other thing that the other groups are trying to do is to force a leadership debate, because obviously what the Poilievre camp is going to want to do is stay in touch with the people that they've signed up, keep them motivated, work on persuasion with the others, and stay out of trouble. And that's harder to do if there is an actual debate, because he'll be focused on staying out of trouble, and the others will be focused on knocking him off his game. So I think that that's the reason why the other campaigns are pushing hard for a leadership debate.
Yeah, on that question of another debate, Greg Weston, 5 out of 6 of the candidates said they'd be happy to have a third official leadership debate. I mean, Poilievre's team hasn't weighed in yet, but how much could another debate really affect this race?
What's it, Mike? We don't really know what's motivating people to start with. You know, these are eye-popping numbers, so there is something other than just really clever recruiting going on here. And I think part of this is, for the first time, certainly in the three leadership races, we have a very polarized contest going on. It's sort of Pierre Poilievre and the rest. And so there's two camps, there's his, and there's everyone else trying to stop him from winning on a first ballot. So I think a lot of those votes that we're seeing, if Melanie's right, and she probably is, 700,000, that's huge. You have to wonder how many of those are trying to stop somebody from winning, trying to stop Poilievre from winning, as much as it is a very impressive, no doubt, recruiting effort on his part. So we don't really know what's driving them at this time. And the other thing, Mike, is there's a whole summertime between now and September, and without a debate or anything else to keep them going, there's not very much that's going to keep all those people engaged. So how many of them will actually turn out and vote? If Anne is right and they turn over those lists, boy, the phones for the 700,000 people are going to be popping all summer long with candidates saying, if you don't vote for me on the first ballot, please vote for this candidate on the second ballot. So it's going to be it's a great race, because nobody can tell what's going to happen.
Yeah, Melanie, and I know you're not part of the decision-making process here, but I'm curious to pick your brain on this. Why didn't the party have another debate after the membership deadline closed? I mean, do they just want this to be decided on the summer barbecue circuit?
No, I don't think that's the case. I think that they set out in the rules early on that there'd be at least two. There's always the option to have more. There's some factors like money. Debates cost a lot of money to organize, to bring people. Like there's a tour component to it. There's a lot that goes into this. And if they're already having a hard time, they're already behind in terms of processing hundreds of thousands of memberships, and then getting ballot packages put together, mailing them out to 600 plus thousand people, maybe as high as 700, depending on what the total number ends up being, mailing those out through Canada Post across the country, giving people enough time to respond to them, to photocopy their driver's license, to mail that back in so that they can vote. That in and of itself is an inordinately huge task. So to add another debate to it, I mean, I'm all for a third debate, but I can also understand why there's a bit of reluctance on the part of the party.
I don't have tons of time left, so guys, I'm going to try and keep all of the answers short if we can. So on that question, though, Greg, of trying to get Greg McEachran, of trying to get people to mail their stuff in, does that sort of, you know, Poilievre's people, will they do that? I mean, there's a question as to whether or not, you know, on this show, we've had a number of guests who are talking about the people who don't trust the gatekeepers, so to speak. Will they be inclined to mail in a photocopy of their driver's license?
Yeah, his true believers may say, well, no, I don't trust anyone. You know, that's the thing about, it's easy to start a fire. It's tougher to control it. So you've got to find a way to keep your people engaged. With Poilievre, it's keeping them angry. If I'm the Conservative Party, I would be pushing for technically a fourth debate. You know, it was Goldilocks. The first one was too hot, the former Manning Institute one. It's a bit crazy. Too chill in Edmonton, asking, you know, they stumped, you know, the leadership candidates with what book they had. And then the one in Quebec was probably just right, but it only probably benefited Charest. And if I'm the Conservative Party, I want the whole country to see the potential team that we're putting together for the next election.
And I wanted to ask you, because you were talking about how much of a machine this is. We had Conservative Party President Rob Batherson on this show yesterday saying they will meet all the deadlines despite being a little behind. I mean, it's such a beast to manage. How do they make sure that there aren't any issues going forward and nobody can question the process?
There will be questions about the process no matter what. There always are. And there's how much legitimacy there will be in those questions is going to be the issue for them. But I will also say that for the staff that are doing that work, they're going to have a tough summer. And we spent last summer in an election campaign. So it's going to be two summers in a row for them of nonstop work.
Greg Weston, I'm putting you under the gun. 15 seconds or less. If you had to advise these candidates what to do on the summer barbecue circuits, what should they be pitching over those pitchers of margaritas?
Vote for, and the point is, the harder it is, you know, the harder they make it to vote, the fewer of them will show up. So it's now just get out your vote, and don't. It's one ballot. It just they mark one ballot, and they mark it a whole bunch of times. So
great advice. Yeah. Greg Weston there. We had Greg McEachran as well, Melanie Paradis and McGrath. Thank you all so much for being with us. Have a great weekend, folks. Coming up next, a new parliamentary committee is calling on Ottawa to boost its efforts to resettle Afghans. But will the government heed those calls? Retired Major General David Fraser, CTV News' military analyst and former commander of NATO forces in southern Afghanistan, joins us next. Stay with us. Power Play will be right back. That's the number of Afghans the federal government has promised to resettle in Canada after the country fell to the Taliban last August. Yesterday, a chartered flight with about 300 refugees arrived in Toronto, bringing the total number of resettled Afghans in Canada to 15,475. Now, that chartered flight landed after a report landed as well from a special parliamentary committee on Afghanistan, and it called on Ottawa to overhaul its refugee system to get more Afghans to safety. The report calls for Immigration, Refugee, and Citizenship Canada to issue single journey travel documents. There are also calls to waive biometric and documentation requirements. Those two things have bogged down the application process for Afghans. There's also the recommendation to improve biometric collection in neighboring countries. The committee wants IRCC to hire more staff to process applications and for Canada to review its anti-terrorism laws so it doesn't restrict aid groups which could be accused of assisting the Taliban as they work on the ground there. Now, this is just a report. There's no guarantee these recommendations will be implemented. So how critical is it to have the government act on all of these recommendations? Let's ask CTV's military analyst, retired Major General David Fraser. He's the former commander of NATO forces in southern Afghanistan, and he was a witness at the parliamentary committee's meeting in drafting this report. Hi, Major General. Thanks for joining us. Now, which one of these 37 recommendations do you see as key to getting Afghans to Canada more quickly?
Well, Mike, it's good to be with you today. And I commend the government, first of all, for having this committee. Secondly, for writing a report and listening to the witnesses who went in front of them. They have certainly taken on board the challenges, and there's no one recommendation that stands out. I would say what the government and bipartisan support has done has listened and recognized that the system needs to be improved by taking on some risk, but not an inordinate amount of risk to bring in not just Afghans, but by implementing these recommendations, we're actually going to help out other situations and crises, much like what we're facing in Ukraine and trying to bring in Ukrainian refugees over to Canada. So this actually has more than just Afghanistan, but I do commend them because it is a good report.
In terms of getting the work done, I mean, you have Parliament that is set to rise for a summer break in just a couple of weeks. Are you hopeful that any of these recommendations will be implemented in that time?
Well, this is all going to come down to execution. They've done the initial work. The hard work now is to take these recommendations and turn them into action. And so I commend the government on doing this. Now I challenge the government for delivering now the effects that they're looking for in the whole of government approach, single-use travel documents, reduce some of the biometrics, and empower IRCC and Global Affairs Canada to allow the people that are working there to actually execute on these recommendations. And so what we need now is who in the government is going to execute on these recommendations. That's the next question we are all going to wait and ask the government to do.
As we wait for that execution, by the government, that execution of and the implementation here of this report, what have you been hearing from the people on the ground in Afghanistan right now?
So when this report came out, I checked with a number of people who are on the ground and who are actually working this, and they're very encouraged by this. And so now I think with the meetings that those charitable organizations like Aman Laura have with the government, the question back to the government will be is, you've now got the recommendations. Can you take the baby steps and expedite some of those procedural improvements, funding, for delivering the desired effects to Canada to facilitate not just the 15,000 people here in Canada, but all 40,000 that the government has stated for itself as an objective to bring here to Canada. So what can we do now to get that done sooner than later?
Thanks so much for your time and for your analysis. That's CTV's military analyst, retired Major General David Fraser. Thanks so much and have a great weekend.
Mike, thank you.
And Melanie Joly is speaking just now at the Summit of the Americas. Here's CTV's Annie Bergeron-Oliver questioning her on the work that the leaders have done there in L.A.
I think that one of the things that we're seeing within the hemisphere is the very big preoccupation regarding how countries are able to have access to funding and financing while at the same time dealing with a climate change crisis. And this is certainly something that the Caribbean countries are talking about, because right now what is available to them is certainly difficult to access. And so as a country that is that has so much in people-to-people ties, particularly in the Caribbeans, and at the same time as a country that has brought so much of the climate change agenda to the forefront, we want to make sure that we're finding solutions to them. Because if we don't, well, there will be more issues with migration, there will be more difficult situations and political unrest, and this will be a cycle that a negative cycle that many of these countries will be going through. So what we want to do is to work at the international level to bring their preoccupation not only in the context of the Summit of the Americas, but also at the G7 next time. This is the role of Canada.
That was Foreign Affairs Minister Melanie Joly at the Summit of the Americas in Los Angeles. Coming up, the Press Gallery is here with their political plays and misplays of the week. Stay right there, everyone. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Last week's landslide victory by the Ontario Progressive Conservatives left two parties looking for a new leader. Plus, the Freedom Convoy continues to haunt the House of Commons. So who scooped up political wins and misses this week in politics? Let's ask the Press Gallery. We have Toronto Star columnist Susan Delacourt. She always offers up political food for thought. And we've got everyone's favorite freelance journalist, Justin Ling. Welcome to both of you. Susan, we will start with you. Why is Liberal MP Nathaniel Erskine-Smith getting a play from you this week?
Bay Nate, as he's called on Twitter, yeah. Beaches East York, Nate Erskine-Smith. Full disclosure, I like Nate Erskine-Smith, and I'll tell you, I have very good journalistic reasons for doing so. He always talks on the record, always. He doesn't play the silly off-the-record, some liberals anonymous sources game. If you're talking to Nate Erskine-Smith, you are getting somebody who puts his name to everything he says. He also doesn't toe the party line. He votes often against his own government. So with that said, when my colleagues and other journalists called him up this week and said, are you thinking of becoming a Liberal leadership candidate, a candidate to succeed Stephen Del Duca, for the provincial Liberals, he said, yes, he is. He is thinking about it. Last night, he sent out a note on Facebook to his wide, wide community out there asking people to send their thoughts. So I'm curious to see, it's almost an experiment. First of all, if Nate does run and he does win, could he be a maverick and as free-spoken as he is now? It would be really interesting to see how you run a party based on those very different rules about political discipline. And I think he'd be a good leader. Not to say that anybody else who's thinking of running wouldn't, but it's a play of the week because he's inserted some interest into that race, for me anyway.
Yeah, and you'd have to think that they have slim pickings so far, but Justin, Erskine-Smith has been a vocal backbencher. Do you think he makes a good leader?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, it's a difficult line to walk. I mean, this is a guy who does not terribly like, being kind of pushed around. He sets his own agenda. He makes his own calls. And, to be honest, I'm not sure it's going to be a good fit for him. Like, I think he wants this. I think he's angling for it. I've certainly heard that he's already made his mind up. It's going to happen. If he ends up there, I think he's going to have a hard time trying to whip caucus. I mean, now maybe he can kind of create a different leadership style that is kind of unique to his kind of brand of mavericking, and maybe that'll work for him. But it's a very difficult thing. It's a very different challenge being, the backbencher that all the journalists love versus being the leader that you kind of have to be the tough guy. I'm not sure it's going to work for him, to be totally honest, but I guess we're going to see.
I think we'll write it down. New word of the day, mavericking. Justin, speaking of, cabinet minister, in your opinion, is getting a misplay this week. Who are you giving it to and why?
it's Marco Mendicino, our public safety minister. He has made a very untidy bed for himself. He's getting a lot of jeers from the Conservative Party and from folks in the media because he intoned, he's being alleged that he said it outright, he did not, but he intoned very heavily that he got advice from police agencies, whether it's the RCMP or whether the Ottawa Police Service. He had advice from them that he needed to invoke the Emergencies Act. And over the last few weeks at the House of Commons hearings on the invocation of the Emergencies Act, we've heard from both our RCMP Commissioner Brenda Lookey, as well as Peter Slowly, the former Ottawa Police Service Chief, as well as from the current OPS leadership, that in fact they didn't ask for this. Their advice was not to invoke the Emergencies Act. And frankly, nor should it have been. This is not necessarily a thing that police decide. But nevertheless, Mendicino some months ago said that he believed that, that the advice they were getting from everybody, police in particular, was to invoke the act. Now, he's been asked repeatedly to clarify this, and he's been giving these rather mealy-mouthed answers. And because he's been so unclear and so unable to clarify what he meant, there is a real accusation now that he has misled Parliament. And frankly, until they come out and say bluntly where this advice came from, who told them to do this, who they consulted on it, they're going to keep getting slammed on this. And it is a problem very much of their own making.
Susan, I've only got about 45 seconds here, so don't get all mavericky on me and go over. But did Mendicino really miss an opportunity to clear this up once and for all?
He could clear it up by making the distinction, I think, that Justin just did. There is a difference between advice and consultations. It is not the police's job. Thank God we don't live in a banana republic to tell the government what to do and vice versa. But I think it puts pressure on the government to release those cabinet documents and release the discussions they had leading up to. I don't know that they've walked themselves back into a corner now on this. I always thought they should release them, but now they kind of have to.
Thank you so much, Susan and Justin. And let's keeping with the Maverick theme, you two can be my wing people any day of the week. Have a great weekend, guys. Well, that's your Power Play Day in Politics. Thanks so much for spending your time with us. Until next time, take care. Enjoy your weekend.